It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Ann Strangeamps. Today, the thrill of the fight.
Let's get ready to rumble!
Who doesn't love a good fight? The beauty of two boxers dancing around the ring, bobbing and weaving until one stands alone. Or the exhilaration of mixed martial artists, kicking and punching until one taps out.
What draws us to combat sport as viewers isn't this opportunity to revel in what's worst in human nature. I think we go to a sport fight because we want to honor and celebrate what's best in human nature.
So who doesn't love a good fight? That would be me. Don't get me wrong. I have nothing against combat sports. After all, I live with two boxing fans. But honestly, watching two people pound each other bloody makes me feel kind of sick. And yet, boxing and mixed martial arts are incredibly popular sports and incredibly lucrative. Take this long-awaited boxing match between Manny Pacquiao and Floyd Mayweather Jr. It's been all over the news. Ringside tickets to that fight sold for $10,000. And that's just the face value. Some people were trying to sell tickets for as high as $350,000. And keep in mind, that's just for one night. So why do we love to watch people fight? Writer Carrie Howley spent months asking herself that question as she followed two mixed martial artists across the Midwest. She tells their story in her new book, Throne, which is narrated by a semi-fictional version of herself named Kit. But the fighters, along with their hopes, their dreams, their injuries, they're real.
I was in a Des Moines conference center, and I was watching, I think there were 11 fights that night. This was my first experience with a live fight. And for the most part, I was kind of interested in this kind of anthropological way. But it was the last fight in which that kind of anthropological disinterest turned to absolute fascination. And that was the fight in which a fighter named Sean Huffman, who did not have the body of a fighter. He's overweight. He kind of had a muffin top over his shorts. He was a little bit short to be fighting in that weight class. And he was fighting a guy named Kevin the Fire Burns. And they went at each other for 5 rounds. And at no point during that fight was Sean winning. Sean was just kind of taking punishment with this waking grace. And to watch such solidity in the face of this encounter, it was an amazing experience.
Did he seem like he was getting hurt? I mean, did he look like he was feeling pain?
No, he didn't. And in fact, the really difficult to manage sources of pain are far more mundane. It's the hunger of trying to make weight for a fight, that kind of gnawing hunger you get when you have to drop 20 pounds in a few weeks. It is the loneliness of leaving home for the first time. It's the soreness after a fight when you have bruised your ankle or something like that. But I think the adrenaline is such, and the sense of abandon is such inside the cage that it's not experienced exactly as we would imagine it.
So tell us about Sean, this person who's decided to devote his life to fighting and taking huge amounts of punishment. That's kind of what he's known for, right?
Yeah, sure. He comes from Knoxville, Tennessee. At the time that I was writing the book, he was 34. And he served some time in Iraq. And when he came home, he wanted to get involved in mixed martial arts. So he ended up driving to Illinois. He shows up at the Miletich fighting camp. And he lasted. He was just incredibly tough and dedicated and talented. I mean, Sean has good technique.
There's this one fight I recall that kind of exemplifies the kind of fights that Sean takes. It's the one with Laverne Clark. Can you tell that story?
So, yeah, he's fighting Laverne Clark, who was a UFC veteran, meaning this is someone who'd really been in the big leagues and was aging out of it at this point. And Sean, and he looked, again, very physically different, Sean being a little bit overweight. And there was confusion over whether it was a 3 or 5 round fight. So that was the level of disorganization, was that the fighters didn't even know how many rounds that they were supposed to be fighting. So Sean...
And Sean didn't even know he was headlining until he arrived.
Oh, that's right.
Right?
Yeah, Sean came late. He had outdated blood work. And when he arrived, he was told that he was headlining. And, you know, he was like, okay. So they got in the cage, and Sean was losing from the beginning. I think he was just gassed. But then Laverne starts to do something which is called 12 to 6-ing, which is elbowing Sean in the spine by punching his elbow down as hard as he can. That's something that's one of the many things that one cannot do in a fight. So Laverne Clark is doing this, and the ref tells him not to. And then Laverne Clark does it 2 more times, at which point the fight is declared, you know, null and void. It's disqualified. And that's how Sean wins that fight.
But so it's this whole picture of, like, incredible disorganization.
Yeah.
You know, and Sean just shows up and he's going to go in the ring no matter what. And then he just gets brutalized and he just takes it. And I guess the thing that gets me is it seems like this is what he likes. For him, this is fighting. This wasn't a bad night necessarily.
Well, I mean, I think that there is a feeling of ecstasy, of abandon, this kind of atavism that the fight makes possible. And that is what Sean is soaking in. So there's a way in which this violence allows Sean to enter this place that feels like no other place he can be. And, I mean, he was ecstatic when he came out of that fight, and I think that's what drew him there.
And do you feel that way, too, watching it? Do you get a hit of that ecstasy?
Yeah, I absolutely do. I mean, I think we can see fighting as a ritual that enables this kind of chaotic, atavistic ecstasy in a society where there just aren't that many opportunities. And to me, MMA was a portal into this world, this feeling that you've been removed from the constraints of your body almost, like you're longing to dissipate into the crowd. I think violence enables that in some ways.
Can you explain why you think that happens? Because honestly, I'm not a fan of fighting, and I don't get it. I don't understand how you can feel ecstatic or how it can feel like an altered experience almost to watch somebody get brutalized.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it is this sense of being freed from the constraints only momentarily of civilization. You know, I had this quote from Artaud's Theater of Cruelty.
The Antonin Artaud, the French... What?
That would be the one. The
French yeah, philosopher.
The French theorist, yes. And, you know, it was above my desk while I was writing, and the quote is, "In our present state of degeneration, it is through the skin that metaphysics must be made to re-enter our minds." There's something that seems to bypass cognition in the midst of a fight where we can achieve this thinking through the body. You know, Artaud also talked about a theater halfway between gesture and thought. You know, not a theater that relied on small psychological insights, but a theater that made space speak, that brought alive something that had seemed inert.
We were talking about the ecstasy of watching a fight. I guess I can see if a fighter, if for some reason the experience of being in the ring, getting pounded and hurting somebody else, if that feels ecstatic to a fighter, I understand that. Don't you think there's something kind of creepy about the fact that there are all these fans getting off on watching somebody else get hurt? I mean, they're getting the ride, but they don't have to risk their bodies.
I guess it depends where you see their attention focused. So if you frame it as they're waiting for somebody to get hurt, which I'm not sure that they are, if you frame it as they're watching two men who have, in a way that most of us can't, rejected the impulse of self-preservation, who are just kind of embracing their bodies as a way to achieve this experience that they can't, or this feeling that they can't access any other way. I mean, I think a missing piece of our conversation is that I was turning 30 when I wrote this book, and turning 30 can, if you let it, be a time of kind of nagging anxiety about the dissipation of your physical being, right? About the little ways in which you feel yourself failing. And in the midst of that, to watch men who were just kind of walking into entropy, who saw their bodies as vehicles for this particular elevating experience, was really thrilling. And, you know, I think there is something real to that elevation, to that desire for a kind of experience that normal life can't give them, that's more than just wanting to hurt somebody else.
Carrie Halley's new book is called Throne. And for me, the minutes leading up to a fight are some of the most agonizing of the whole event. Watching two fighters stare each other down, it's kind of a terrifying moment. Every time I see it, I wonder, what are they thinking? Are they nervous? Frightened? Angry? Well, here's some insight on what goes on in a fighter's head, courtesy of English professor and mixed martial arts enthusiast, Jonathan Gottschall.
It's the night of March 31st, 2012, and I am standing half naked in the chain link cage. I'm bouncing restlessly from foot to bare foot, trying to vent the tension building at my core. I can see the young man coming through the crowd to break my face, to strangle me to sleep. It's like a nightmare. I'm 39 years old. I'm an English teacher at a small liberal arts college. I've never experienced real violence, never even been in a fight, but that's about to change. The referee stands sideways between us. He shouts to each of us in turn, "Fighter, are you ready?" We nod. In the next heartbeat, civilization will melt away. The law will disappear, and we will meet at the center of the cage to try to kill each other. The referee yells, "Fight," and so we do.
That's Jonathan Gottschall reading from his book, The Professor in the Cage, Why Men Fight and Why We Like to Watch. We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll hear about how that mild-mannered English professor wound up in the ring, and we'll meet women's boxing phenom and Olympic gold medalist, Claressa Shields. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. We're talking about the thrill of the fight in this hour. For years, Jonathan Gottschall led something of a double life. By day, he was a mild-mannered English professor at a private liberal arts college in western Pennsylvania. But by night, he was a merciless mixed martial artist, sparring and trading punches at his local gym. Gottschall started fighting out of curiosity, but he wound up in the ring, challenging a fighter 15 years younger. He tells the story in a new book called The Professor in the Cage. Steve Paulson talked with him.
Well, Jonathan, no offense, but you would seem to be a really unlikely candidate to be a mixed martial arts fighter. I mean, you're an English professor at a small liberal arts college. You have a comfortable life with a wife and two kids. Why did you want to learn how to fight?
Yeah, there was a few reasons I did it. I had personal reasons for wanting to do it. I was sort of at a stage of my life where I sort of needed a quest, and the MMA gym opened up across the street. You know, I'd never done a brave thing, and, you know, I wanted to go across there and see if I was capable of it, to see if I
had any courage in me. But I also had, you know, scholarly and intellectual interests. You know, I wanted to ask this question, this big question, what has to be maybe the most important question, which is, why do men fight? And I was also interested in this question about why we, you know, those of us who aren't violent, why do we so readily sit back and cheer violent men on? Because violence is, even more than sex, the great staple of our entertainment economies. Even those of us who wouldn't be caught dead at a cage fight or at a boxing match still consume a really rich diet of entertainment violence. And I was curious about why that was so.
Yeah. So you joined this gym, this mixed martial arts gym, and you trained. In fact, you trained quite seriously, and to the point where you started engaging in what people in the gym called punch in the face nights. What happened there?
Oh, punch in the face night was a horror show. Punch in the face night, you know, at a mixed martial arts gym, you can get punched in the face any night of the week. But some nights at the gym, you know, you'd work on your wrestling, you'd work on jiu-jitsu and other grappling art, and no glove leather would fly at all. But on punch in the face night, you knew you were going to be punched in the face dozens and dozens of times.
Yeah. So what happened during these punch in the face nights? I mean, did you end up walking around with lots of bruises on your face?
Yeah, I had lots of bruises on my face. I had bruises all over my body. You know, to do MMA is to hurt. You know, even sleeping hurts. You're just chafed. You're twisted. You're bruised. You're swollen.
Did you like to fight?
I did in some ways. I was always scared of it. I always had a lot of fear and anxiety about it. But there is an excitement to it that is hard to match. You know, there's a thrill to it. On the nights when I did well at the gym, when I sort of held my own in the sparring, and those nights were few and far between, I would leave the gym with my whole system like revving with something bigger and purer than a runner's high. And I enjoyed the camaraderie, I enjoyed the exercise, I enjoyed the guys in the gym. And when I finally had to quit, I quit because I was just too injured to go on. I trained there for about 3 years. And when I left the gym for the final time, I left it feeling very sad, like this romance in my life had ended and I was too old and too brittle to recapture it.
I can imagine also that when you were walking back across the street to your day job, being an English professor, your academic colleagues must have thought you had a few screws loose. I mean, especially when they saw, you know, all these marks on your face.
Yeah, you know, I tried to keep it secret for a long time, to be honest. But after a while, you know, it's very hard to stay in the closet. You're showing up at work in crutches. You're showing up at work with black eyes. And so eventually I had to tell them. I was kind of worried what people would think. I was worried that they'd think I was a savage and that I was a violent guy and that, you know, I just wasn't a good person or something like that. But once I told them, you know, no one cared. They weren't angry with me or upset with me. They were much more tolerant than I expected them to be.
Hmm. Now, you were engaging in mixed martial arts. Do you remember the first time you ever saw a mixed martial arts fight?
Yeah, I was at a party almost 20 years ago, and somebody broke out a Blockbuster video cassette tape, and we watched a sumo wrestler fight a 200-pound karate man. And the fight was very, very brutal and very, very fast. It ended with the karate fighter winding up as hard as he could and soccer kicking the sumo wrestler in the face and then landing a haymaker punch after that. The fight ended in 20 seconds.
Wow, and so, that is brutal. I mean, it's frankly kind of horrifying.
I was horrified watching it. I was watching this thinking, oh my gosh, what kind of savage would want to watch this? What kind of monster would want to watch this stuff? And then the next fight came on, and I found that I could not look away.
Now, there's another piece to this story, the more scholarly piece, which is why men fight. I mean, the big intellectual question that you were looking at. And you say that a lot of it revolves around a certain kind of behavior that you call the monkey dance. What is that?
If you've ever seen a nature video of two elephant seals squaring off in the surf, or of two rams cracking skulls on a hillside. Biologists call those kinds of contests ritual combat. It's a way that different species have evolved to find out who's bigger and stronger and fitter and tougher without the danger of fighting it out for real. And I argue that the same is true of people, just more so. And the monkey dance is my name for human versions of ritual combat. Everything from deadly duels to verbal duels to the roughhousing of boys to sports. And probably the best example I can give you of this is the choreography of a standard fistfight. Sociologists have studied this pretty extensively, and fistfights always follow, or almost always follow, a typical pattern. Someone feels dishonored or disrespected. There's a challenge. The men argue back and forth. At any point, either one of these guys can back down and walk away, and usually they do. But if no one will back down, they close the distance, they punch, they push, they tackle, they gouge. What I'm getting at is that the standard choreography of a fistfight, the back and forth dance of it, seems to be as hardwired into us as patterns of conflict are hardwired into those mountain goats cracking skulls on the hillside.
So there's an element of honor here. I mean, that's what not wanting to back down is all about, to save your honor.
Yeah, that's right. Most mano a mano type conflict between men is honor-based violence.
And yet it would seem that our culture is less of an honor-based society than many cultures have been in the past.
There's no question that this sort of violence, the sort of honor-based violence, is in decline. But it's not gone. You know, so the guys who come into my gym are of an age where physical violence and physical aggression, physical intimidation between men is most common. And they're of a class, they're mainly working class guys, where backing down in the face of a challenge still comes with stiff social consequences. Most of the guys who go into MMA gyms aren't training to win sport fights. What they're training for is if they're in the outside world and a guy comes up to them and tries to bully them, they want to be able to defend themselves. They want to be able to stand up for themselves and not be dishonored.
There are all kinds of troubling questions here. I mean, one is, I mean, you're drawing the link between masculinity and the ability to fight. Sort of raising this question, are you a lesser man if you walk away from a fight?
Absolutely not. Walking away from the fight is the right thing to do. However, most guys who do walk away from a fight, it's not a cost-free move. There's a social cost to pay for it, and there's a psychological cost to pay for it. So I tell stories in the book about the fights that I walked away from. And you know it's the right thing to do. You know it's a civilized thing to do. But we have this honor psychology that's developed over the course of eons worth of evolutionary time. And it feels like it's not the right thing to do. It feels really bad to walk away from a fight.
You can feel ashamed of doing that. I mean, you've wimped out, or you might feel that
exactly,
way.
Exactly. So I'm an educated person. I'm a civilized person. For God's sake, I'm an English professor. And I still get into these situations where I would walk away from, and this doesn't happen all the time, but I would walk away from a physical confrontation, knowing it was the right thing to do at an intellectual level, knowing it's the right thing to do at a moral level, and then feeling so ashamed of myself that I couldn't look at myself in the mirror. And I'm not endorsing this kind of primitive masculinity. I'm just saying that this is how most men feel.
There's another side to this, and that's not just sort of being in a fight. It's enjoying the spectacle of fighting, you know, as entertainment. And mixed martial arts it's a huge business right now, very popular on television. And I have to confess, I'm a longtime boxing fan.
Right.
And I feel kind of guilty about that, I have to say. You know, these people are risking brain damage to some degree for my pleasure.
Agreed.
What do you do with that?
Well, you know, I started thinking about this question 20 years ago when I started watching mixed martial arts on a regular basis. And I'd watch it, and always with this spirit of guilty fascination, I'd think to myself, I'm a peace-loving, civilized person. I appear not to be a sociopath. Yet here I am watching this. What's wrong with me? And what's wrong with all of us? Because even those of us, again, who are not going to want to watch cage fights or boxing matches still consume a massive diet of entertainment violence, everything from NFL games to gore-spattered novels to films and video games. So I came around to the view that what draws us to combat sport as viewers isn't so much the barbarism or the bloodlust. So I don't know about you, but I don't ever want to watch an ISIS torture slash murder video. But I find it very hard not to watch men fighting. And partly I think it's because it's such an incredibly intense drama. The emotions are so real and raw, and the broken hearts are real, and the pain is real, and the elation is real. The drama of it is intense. And a fight also sets up these conditions of incredibly harrowing adversity that allow the best elements of human nature to shine through. Talking about things that we all admire, like courage and boldness and extremes of grace and endurance and fortitude. So I think I'll sound to many people like an apologist for violence, but I think what draws us to combat sport as viewers isn't this opportunity to succumb to or to revel in what's worst in human nature. I think we go to a sport fight because we want to honor and celebrate what's best in human nature.
So I have to come back to where we started.
Sure.
Your training to be a cage fighter, you trained for 3 years. You finally got into a cage fight. What happened?
Well, you know, I don't want to give the ending of the book away. You know, I built a little bit of suspense into the story, and so I don't want to give it away. I will tell you, though, that I'm an English professor. I'm 40 years old. I fought a 24-year-old, and it didn't go all that well.
Thank you. This has been a lot of fun.
Jonathan Gottschall is an English professor at Washington and Jefferson College in Pennsylvania. His latest book is The Professor in the Cage, Why Men Fight and Why We Like to Watch. Steve Paulson talked with him. You know, it's not just men who fight. There's a women's boxing circuit, and at the top of it is Claressa Shields. She's been boxing since she was 11 years old, and today she's got more than 40 wins to her name and only one loss. She's also the subject of a forthcoming documentary called T-Rex.
I have this dream. I'm in England, London, and it's the finals in the Olympics. I can hear the announcer. I mean, they're gonna say it, like, and the first woman Olympian at 165 pounds is Claressa Shields.
Claressa Shields realized that dream in 2012 when she became the first American to win a gold medal in Olympic women's boxing. These days, she's back in her hometown of Flint, Michigan, training and preparing for her next fight. So what's it like to be one of the best fighters in the world? Charles Monroe Kane called Claressa to find out.
Will you take me back to 2012, to the Olympics? What was that like?
You know, for years, you know, like that was my dream, to go to the Olympics and win a gold medal. And then when it happened, I just felt like it was surreal. I was really happy, and I felt like I was floating for at least the whole month. Like, I don't think that my feet touched the ground for a while.
You've been doing this since you're 11. And I have a question for you now. You've won a gold medal. What makes, not a good fighter, not a decent fighter, what makes a great fighter?
I think what makes a great fighter is discipline. To be a great fighter, I feel like I'm a great fighter, but I feel like I can be greater. And a great fighter goes above their potential. They know they can be a lot more than what they are. That's what I think makes a great fighter.
So for people that don't know your story, tell us how you got into boxing.
I got into boxing because of my dad. We were like having a conversation. My dad went to prison when I was 2, and he got out when I was 9. And when I met him, we were just like the best of friends. And I felt he was just this great guy, this great old man, you know, who didn't really get a chance to live his life. And when he was talking to me, he said he wished he would have stuck to what he was passionate about. And I asked him, I just said, you know, what were you passionate about? And he said boxing. And from that day, I just decided that I would box so my dad could live some of his life through me because I knew it would make him happy.
Is that what motivates you to get up at 5 in the morning to work out, to diet, to punch, to be punched. Is that enough motivation? Why do you fight?
You know what? Why do I box? I just love boxing. That's my happy place. You know, when I get in the ring, after all that hard work of training, I think I just do it to, because I bring hope to my family, my friends, and my fans. But even though training camp might suck and training camp might be hard, but just getting my hand raised, knowing that I did it all for something, that's why I box, because I know I can be something great.
You're quite the star. I think the problem seems to be that other people still can't seem to accept a woman in the ring.
Yeah, I wish they would just... They need to look at me as not a manly woman, but a strong woman to actually fight. I'm not fighting against men. I can beat a lot of men up, yes, but I'm not fighting against men. I'm fighting against women.
What do you think they're afraid of?
A lot of men do not want to accept the fact that a woman may be able to beat them at something physical.
You talked about discipline earlier, and I do agree that boxing is a lot about discipline, but you seem to have some anger out there, too. What role does anger have in being a good boxer?
I don't be angry when I'm in a ring. I guess I can say where I grew up at is either, it's like kind of like kill or be killed. And that's how I feel in the ring. I don't want to kill my opponent, but it's like either I'm going to hurt them or they're going to hurt me. Which one is it going to be? You know, and I refuse to let anybody hurt me. So I just get in there and I think of the worst thing that can happen and I do my best to try to prevent it.
When you won the gold, how did you think it was going to change your life?
You know what? I thought after winning the Olympics, I thought I would get endorsements, sponsorships. I thought I would be on magazine covers, like posing with gloves. I thought I would be, you know, America's golden girl. Because, I mean, I was the first woman to win an Olympic gold medal ever. I mean, at 165 pounds. Only three women in the world who got Olympic gold medals in women's boxing. And I thought that when I did it, that it wasn't about being, you know, rich. I thought I would get the recognition of not just being African-American, but also being the first person ever to do something.
Now, that didn't happen, did it?
No, it didn't.
I mean, I'm not trying to be mean, but, like, how do you feel about that?
At first, it was pretty hard to accept, and I just was like, wow, you know, I'm not getting any recognition, any respect. You know, I sacrificed all my childhood to represent America, and America isn't doing anything, you know, back to be supportive, like, you know, for saying, okay, since you did this, this is what we're going to do for you. I just felt like, wow, what did I do it for? But then after a while, I just was like, you know, the past is the past. No one can ever take away that I won the Olympic. And I'm like, you know what? To make an even bigger statement, since they want to ignore me this time, I'll make sure I'm better prepared 2016. And I'll go back and do it again.
You know, right now, like you said, you're the number one boxer in the world, a female boxer in the world. You won one gold medal. You're coming up at another Olympics. By the time this interview airs, the hype over the Pacquiao-Mayweather fight will have subsided. And win or lose, those guys are going to make hundreds of millions of dollars each.
Yep.
When you look at that, what do you think of that?
I think that's great for them, but I want to be the first woman to ever get paid like that to get the recognition. I want to be the first woman to fight on HBO, Showtime. I want to be the first woman to do all that. ESPN, I want to be on TV. And that's why I feel like if I keep building up my resume, I'm setting myself up for greatness.
So what do you think you have to do to make that happen? What do you think, after you win the gold again, you go pro? Is that what you have to do as a woman? Do you have to do stuff differently? I mean, what has to happen?
Yes. Yeah, I have to go pro after 2016. I want to go pro, and I feel like that would be the best thing for women's boxing. You know, I feel like God bless people sometimes to have regular lives, but then some people are blessed to be extraordinary. And I feel like I'm one of those people. And after 2016, after I win another Olympic gold medal, I'm going to go professional. And I think that's going to be great.
Claressa Shields. She won the gold medal in the middleweight division at the 2012 Olympic Games. She's the subject of the forthcoming documentary, T-Rex. Coming up, more teenage warriors. Writer Saba Tahir has launched the latest YA sensation, An Ember in the Ashes. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge. From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now it's time for A Dangerous Idea.
My name's John Ronson. I'm the author of The Psychopath Test and Lost at Sea and Frank and Men State Goats and Them. My dangerous idea is, can real-life superheroes surpass the police in crime fighting? Now, this isn't really my idea. It's the idea of a real-life superhero in Seattle called Phoenix Jones. I spent a bunch of time with Phoenix and with other real-life superheroes across America. We turned the corner, and it was like 3 o'clock in the morning at Belltown in Seattle, and it was like The Wire. This group of guys were like saying, "What are you doing coming here with your superhero costumes? This may be fun and games to you, but it's not fun and games to us. This is how we feed our families." You know, I was obviously nodding in agreement with everything the crack dealers were saying, in the hope that if the shooting started, they'd considerately remember to shoot around me. Because the superheroes all had like bulletproof vests on. I had like a T-shirt and a cardigan. And I still had my suitcase actually with me. Anyway, eventually the crack dealer said to Phoenix, "If you don't get off our block, we're going to show you what the burner do." Those were his very words. So I thought I remembered from watching The Wire that a burner was a stolen mobile phone, but that didn't sound contextually right at all. So, if you don't get off our block, we'll show you our stolen mobile phones. So I said to Phoenix, "What's a burner?" And Phoenix said, "It's a gun." And then they all came towards us. About four or five of these guys all came towards us with their hands down their pockets. And then one of them whispered, "You know, if you don't get off our block, we're going to kill you." And then they all kind of gathered at the bottom. And Phoenix said to his superhero cohorts, "Do we stand or do we leave?" And they both went, "We stand." I was utterly terrified. I mean, I've done a lot of dangerous things in my line of work, but this felt like, really, like this could be the end. I was utterly terrified. And then they all started walking towards us and they got to us. And one of them said, "You are seriously willing to die for this?" And Phoenix said, "Yeah." And I said, "Well, if you're going to be so stupid as to die for this, then I guess we're going to have to go home." And they all dispersed and went home. And so Phoenix won. Phoenix won. Phoenix said, "We're going to stay for an hour and consolidate the block. Do you want to stay with us?" And I said, "No, I do not." And so I went back to my hotel where my legs buckled and gave way and I fell onto the floor.
Writer John Ronson with his dangerous idea. You can hear more dangerous ideas by visiting our website at ttbook.org. Move over, Hunger Games. There are some new teen warriors in town, or at least between the covers of a book. This week we're thinking about the much-anticipated debut YA novel by Saba Tahir. It's called An Ember in the Ashes, an epic fantasy set in a world reminiscent of ancient Rome. The book's just been released, but movie rights have already been snatched up, and there's talk about a sequel. So Charles Monroe Kane caught up with Saba Tahir to discover what all this buzz is about.
Could you, for our grown-up listeners out there in public radio land, can you describe this book for us?
Sure thing. An Ember in the Ashes is a young adult fantasy. It is about two people, a girl named Laya who is fighting for her family, and a soldier named Elias who is fighting for his freedom. Laya and Elias live under a really brutal military empire, and when Laya's brother is taken by Empire soldiers and tossed into prison, she knows she has to get him back. He's been accused of treason, and that's basically a death sentence. The problem is Laya's not very brave, so she's not sure how to get him back. And her part of the book is really about her journey to finding the courage to save her brother. Elias is a soldier of the Empire, and he doesn't want to be a soldier anymore. He attends a military academy called Blackcliff, where he's been training for 14 years, and all he really wants to do is escape this place and find his freedom. But before he can do that, he's ordered to participate in a series of tests that will decide the next martial emperor. So when Laya and Elias's paths cross, they realize that their fates are intertwined and that their decisions are going to change the future of the very empire in which they live.
Oh, that sounds great. Sounds like fun to write.
Thank you.
You know, I did something different. I got your book, the galley copy, a couple months ago, and I said to myself, wait a minute. I have a 10-year-old son, and this is the kind of books he reads. So I thought I'd take it home to him and see if it's any good, and then I'd interview you. But he really liked it. So then he started talking to his friends about it, and he got two neighbor girls, a girl named Sophia and Lydia. They're 9 and 10, and he's 10. And I had them all read it, and I had them write all the questions that I'm going to ask you today. But first, I want you to hear their little discussion of last night where I got together with them and said, hey, you guys, what did you think about the book? And here's what they had to say.
So I like the way she described all the characters and the personalities and all the sequences that happen. It's really cool. She's a really good author.
I like how she explained every little detail.
And Ember in the Ashes was really good because she really described everything, so you could really get the good picture in your mind of what the characters were doing at the time.
I've never read a book like this because it's different, so it's different to me. That's another reason I really liked it a lot, because I got a chance to explore new, different kinds of books.
What about the violence?
It was awesome!
It was deranged. I've never read anything like with violence.
What do you think of the love part of the book?
I think it's unnecessary.
I think it basically showed that love can be dangerous.
Yep.
It can make people unhappy. And for what happened.
And angry too.
Yeah.
That was the best thing I've ever heard. I'm like struggling not to tear up right now. That was so great to listen to.
Basically what I did with the kids last night is I made them assignment was that by the yesterday they had to have write 10 questions each. They had to write it out. And last night we discussed the questions. So here's some questions. I want to start with Lydia. I think she asked, I think, a pretty basic question, but an important one. She said, where did the idea for this book come from?
Ember was inspired by two things. The first was that, you know, I grew up in this isolated town in the Mojave Desert where I really didn't feel like I fit in. I was picked on. I watched my parents and my family deal with a lot of racism. So I felt very voiceless and, you know, isolated as a kid. And I turned to books to deal with that feeling. So, you know, as I grew, I sort of realized that I could find a voice and I could find my own power through writing. And in 2007, I decided, you know, I want to write a book. And I didn't know what it was going to be about. I just knew that it would be about people who like me as a kid, you know, felt like outcasts and who feel powerless. You know, people who just feel like they have, you know, no voice and that they're very stifled. At the same time, I was working at the Washington Post as a copy editor, and I was reading about some truly voiceless and powerless people, the Sudanese genocide, extrajudicial jailings in Kashmir, child soldiers in Colombia and the DRC, and, you know, all of that sort of combined to plant the seed for Ember.
And so are you in the book? I mean, are you permeated throughout it? You're
yes.
The young you?
Yeah, Laya is very similar to the teenage me. I was not very brave. I was not somebody who was willing to stick up for myself or to stick up for anyone. You know, I was just too sort of timid and afraid. Elias, the other character, is somebody who has a lot of empathy. And I think because of my youth and sort of being picked on, I've always had that. And it grew when I became a teenager because, you know, I think I was sort of more emotionally capable of understanding what other people might be going through. So Elias's empathy, I think, also comes from me.
Now, I have a question from Sophia. This one's an interesting one for you. She says, and I'm going to quote it here. She says, as the author, who did you want to love each other more? And is that what ended up in the book?
this is where I can sort of talk a little bit about how much these characters, how real they are to me.
Uh-huh.
It's almost like they act on their own volition and I just sort of record it. They're like family members to me. I've had them in my head for years now. So I wasn't like, oh, I really, really hope that, you know, Laya ends up with Elias or Laya ends up with Kenan or, you know, mm-hmm. Helene ends up with Elias. I was sort of thinking more like, I hope that they achieve their goals and I hope that they find happiness.
So if someone breaks their heart or is killed, do you feel it? I mean, is this something?
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Yes. There is a scene in the book where one of the more villainous characters has lost someone really important to him. And I actually was really sad when I wrote that scene because even though this character is not very nice, I know that he had a very deep love for the person that he lost. And, you know, it hurts to do that to a character, to take something from them. There are other characters in the book who die, and that hurt not just because of, you know, because I like them as characters, but because of the manner in which they die, which is hard, you know?
Yeah.
So it definitely takes a toll. Like I wrote the first scene I was talking about and I was like moping around the house and, you know, my husband was like, what's wrong? And I was like, I had to kill a character. And, you know, luckily he gets it. He's sort of, you know, been living with me for a while, so he knows. But, you know, it's very real. It's a very real feeling.
You said earlier that you, as a youth, you know, because of race and other issues, you were picked on and you felt powerless, and these characters became, you know, examples of parts of your past. When one of them is empowered or one of them dies off, does that happen to you as well?
I think that it does to a degree. When Laya, for example, was showing her cowardice, it like really bothered me. You know, and that was where I sort of had to learn not to pull my punches and not to just turn her into what I want her to be or what I would have wanted myself to be at that age. I had to let her develop on her own.
Mm. That's interesting. You know, Lydia wanted to know, and again, this is a quote. She said, with so much violence and war and stuff, why do you have your characters love each other at all?
Because I think that that's an accurate representation of our world. And that's what's wonderful about our world, and that's what should give us hope, is that even in, you know, the darkest times and the darkest situations, we can still have the capacity to both love and hope. And that's a really wonderful thing that I think we should celebrate.
Now, of course, love is not the only theme in your book. There's also a lot of violence and war that plays a heavy role. My son, Odin, he wanted to know, and I'll quote him here, he said, how in the world did you come up with the mask design, and what does it mean that it's permanent? And I guess you should explain the mask to listeners first.
Sure. So students at Blackcliff Academy, which is the scary, scary academy, where Elias is training, are given a mask at the age of 14. And they put that mask on, and it is made of living metal. So it ends up merging with their face over time so that their skin is silver, and it's like a part of them. You can see their features underneath it. I decided to write about the mask because I saw something on television. I think it was a report about like rioters in Eastern Europe somewhere. And there was a line of rioters and a line of police, and the police had shields and masks over their face. And the expressions on the faces of the rioters were so open and angry, sometimes scared. And the riot police were sort of this wall, you know, with no feeling. There was no emotion there. And that image really stuck with me. That is also a part of our world and something that I thought was worth exploring.
Why permanent? Why are the masks don't come off?
They don't come off because I think that with every action that these young soldiers take that is really violent or oppressive, it becomes more a part of them. As their training continues and they become more committed to the empire, their chances of sort of ever turning back are diminished. And so, you know, the mask sinks in with them and it becomes a part of them because in the same way that your actions and your history become a part of you.
Well, but the kids really wanted to know something last night. And they wanted to know, once the mask is permanently a part of your face, does that mean you're a human being beyond hope?
No, it does not.
My son and his friends, they're 10 and 9, but they're reading the teenage stuff. Hunger Games, Divergent, The Maze, you know, on and on and on and on. These are all dystopias. They're bleak, They're dark and they have a terrible view of humanity. And I worry sometimes, I'm like, are we teaching them that humanity's bad? and I'm wondering if you, as a young adult writer, do you feel like you have some responsibility with the idea of hope for these young readers?
I personally feel like I have that responsibility because hope has played such a big role in my life. And it is something that I think is so important for young readers, all readers, but young readers in particular, to really to take with them into adulthood, which is, you know, not to become embittered and not to lose hope, even in really bad situations. So a lot of the darkness in Ember is, you know, it is reflective of the darkness in our world. And I think that it's important for young people to know that that exists, because at some point we will all come up against it.
Right.
And in that way, they might be a little bit more prepared. But at the same time, I think it's important for readers to know that hope is just as powerful. It's not nothing in the face of darkness. It's a very powerful force.
Well, thank you very, very much. It was a great book. The kids in the neighborhood loved it.
I think that is so wonderful. Please, please tell them I say thank you for all their thoughtful questions. That's awesome.
Saba Tahir is the author of the new YA novel, An Ember in the Ashes. She talked with Charles Monroe Kane. And thanks to our young readers, Odin, Sophia, and Lydia. If you like what you heard this hour, subscribe to our podcast. Just look us up on iTunes, Stitcher, or any other podcasting app. And while you're there, it'd be great if you could leave us a review. That really helps other people discover the show. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Madison, Wisconsin, and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. Raymond Tungekar produced today's show, with help from Charles Monroe Kane, Craig Ely, and Doug Gordon. Our theme music is from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.